Welcome to Circulation on the Run, your weekly podcast summary and backstage pass to the Journal and its editors. We're your co-hosts. I'm Dr. Carolyn Lam, Associate Editor from the National Heart Center and Duke National University of Singapore.
And I'm Dr. Greg Hunley, Associate Editor, Director of the Poly Heart Center at VCU Health in Richmond, Virginia.
Greg, this week's feature paper is on one of my favorite topics, SGLT2 inhibitors, and this time looking at their association with the risk of hyperkalemia in people with type 2 diabetes. Now, this is something we've all been waiting to look at. It's a meta-analysis of individual participant data from randomized controlled trials. So, a very important, clinically applicable discussion coming right up. But first, I'm actually going to talk to you about text messages.
Wow, Carolyn. I can't wait to hear about this article.
Well, specifically, the text meds randomized clinical trial, which is our first paper today. And it is a trial that examined the effectiveness of text message delivered cardiac education and support on medication adherence following an acute coronary syndrome. And this is from Dr. Clara Chow from University of Sydney and her colleagues, who performed a single-blind, multi-center, randomized controlled trial of post-ACS patients across 18 rural and urban centers in three time zones in Australia. The control group received usual care, and the intervention group additionally received multiple motivational and supportive weekly text messages on medications and healthy lifestyle with the opportunity for two-way communication.
Wow, Carolyn. So text messaging to facilitate medication adherence. I can't wait to hear. So what did they find?
So I think the design, and it's such a neat study. However, the study found no significant impact on the primary outcome of medication adherence at 6 and 12 months, nor on LDL cholesterol or blood pressure. However, intervention participants were more likely to achieve a normal body mass index and to eat guideline-recommended servings of fruit and vegetables. Qualitative analysis demonstrated a high level of acceptability, utility in being a unified source of information, high program engagement, and emotional support, especially during times of uncertainty.
Interesting, Carolyn. So it sounds like an impact on diet. So what did we learn from this study?
Well, customized and personalized text message-based prevention programs are indeed a scalable and low-cost means of delivering consistent education and support to patients following hospitalization for ACS. So this study shows it's feasible. The lack of impact, however, on medical adherence, though with better adherence to healthy lifestyle practices, suggests that maybe external factors such as cost may strongly influence medical adherence, and these need to be addressed in addition to education programs to improve medical adherence. But all of this is discussed in a beautiful editorial entitled Opportunities and Challenges of Mobile Health Tools to Promote Health Behaviors by Dr. Sharma and Avram.
Very nice, Carolyn. What a great summary. Well, my paper comes to us from Professor Mario Del Mar from New York University School of Medicine. And Carolyn, exercise training as well as catecholaminergic stimulation increases the incidence of arrhythmic events in patients affected with arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy, or ARVC. And this correlates with plakophilin 2 mutations. Now, Carolyn, separate data show that reduced abundance of plakophilin 2 leads to dysregulation of intracellular calcium homeostasis. And Carolyn, these authors studied the relation between exercise and/or catecholaminergic stimulation, intracellular calcium homeostasis, and arrhythmogenesis in plakophilin 2 deficient murine hearts.
Ooh, so what were the effects?
Right, Carolyn. So for training, the mice underwent 75 minutes of treadmill running once per day, 5 days each week for 6 weeks. And the authors observed that exercise disproportionately affected calcium intracellular homeostasis in plakophilin 2 deficient hearts in a manner facilitated by stimulation of intracellular beta adrenergic receptors or hyperphosphorylation of phospholamban. Now, these cellular changes created a proarrhythmogenic state that can be mitigated by ranitidine receptor blockade. Additionally, Carolyn, these authors' data unveiled an arrhythmogenic mechanism for exercise-induced or catecholaminergic life-threatening arrhythmias in the setting of a deficit in plakophilin-2. They suggest that membrane-permeable beta blockers are potentially more efficient for ARVC patients. And also, they highlight the potential for ryanodine receptor channel blockers as treatment for the control of heart rhythm in this population at risk, and propose that plakophilin-dependent and phospholamban-dependent ARVC-related arrhythmias have a common mechanism.
Wow, thanks again, Greg. That was really, really a nice explanation. Well, for this next original paper, it looks at the question of the association between major bleeding and non-major clinically relevant bleeding with subsequent mortality in hospitalized patients. And authors did this by exploring this relationship in the Magellan and Mariner trials of extended thromboprophylaxis in hospitalized medical patients.
Wow, Carolyn. So, you know, I can't quite remember, and maybe for our listeners, remind us of the design of the Magellan and the Mariner trials.
Well, these trials evaluated whether rivaroxaban compared with enoxaparin or placebo could prevent venous thromboembolism without increased bleeding. And the authors, led by Dr. Spiropoulos from the Feinstein Institute of Medical Research in New York, hypothesized that patients with major bleeding, but not those with non-major clinically relevant bleeding, would be at an increased risk of all-cause mortality. So, Greg, would you like to guess what they found?
Oh, Carolyn, you've put me on the spot here. I'm not sure.
Maybe just, yeah, did the authors get it right or wrong? Just.
I'm saying they got it right.
Oh, always. Clever. So they found that compared to patients with no bleeding, the risk of all-cause mortality for patients with non-major clinically relevant bleeding was not increased in Mariner, but was increased in Magellan. Major bleeding, however, was associated with a higher incidence of all-cause mortality in both studies, while trivial bleeding was not associated with mortality in either study. So these results really inform the risk-benefit calculus of extended thromboprophylaxis in medically ill patients.
Wow, Carolyn, great presentation. Well, you know, we've got some other articles in this issue, and let me tell you about two that I have. First, there's a research letter from Professor Frankel entitled Trends in Opioid Use After Cardiac Implantable Electronic Device Procedures in the United States between the years of 2004 and 2020. And Tracy Hampton from the National Association of Science Writers presents some very recent news in the world of cardiology.
Nice. Well, there's an exchange of letters as well between Drs. Yang and Nagareddy regarding the article Retention of NLP3 Inflammasome-Primed Neutrophils in the Bone Marrow is Essential for Myocardial Infarction-Induced Granulopoiesis. And finally, in the editor's page, a nice piece from Drs. Joe Hill, Darren McGuire, and James DeLemus on Circulation Best Papers 2021. Gosh, really, really nice issue. Now let's go on, though, to the feature discussion, yeah?
You bet.
Welcome to this episode of Circulation on the Run podcast. My name is Mercedes Carnathon, one of the associate editors, and I'm a professor of preventive medicine at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. I'm really excited today to have a guest with us, Dr. Brendan Nguyen, who has shared with us his really outstanding research on SGLT2 inhibitors and the risk of hyperkalemia in people with type 2 diabetes, a meta-analysis. So welcome to our podcast today, Brendan.
Thanks very much for having me, Mercedes. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us. We're really pleased that you chose Circulation to share with us your really important findings. Can you tell us a little bit about the rationale for your study and how you carried out your work?
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that in people with diabetes and people with CKD, Hyperkalemia is a common occurrence, and it's a problem for two reasons, as you'd be aware. Firstly, it is associated with cardiac dysrhythmias, and secondly, perhaps at least as importantly, it limits the optimal use of treatments that reduce kidney disease progression and heart failure events. So that is agents that block the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. We now know, and we've got robust evidence from large outcome trials, that SGLT2 inhibitors reduce the risk of heart failure and kidney disease progression in people with and without diabetes. But we haven't really, up until now, systematically evaluated their effect on potassium outcomes, particularly hyperkalemia. And so we set out to assess whether these agents affect serum potassium levels and alter the risk of hyperkalemia as well as hypokalemia.
Well, thank you. That sounds like a really excellent and well-needed study. Given how much we've heard within the field about the benefits of SGLT2 inhibitors, it's nice to see a careful evaluation of what, you know, some of the considerations are in their use. So tell us a little bit about how you carried out this study and what you ultimately found.
So what we did was we identified clinical trials that enrolled people with type 2 diabetes at high cardiovascular risk or with chronic kidney disease. And what we did is we approached the investigators of each of these trials and asked them to collaborate on a large meta-analysis using individual participant data. What that allowed us to do was then standardize across all of the trials different outcome definitions, and allowed us to assess the effect of SGLT2 inhibitors on a primary outcome of time to first serum potassium greater than or equal to 6, defined as serious hyperkalemia, as well as hypokalemia, investigator-reported hyperkalemia events, and a range of other potassium-related outcomes in a broad population, including people with chronic kidney disease, people with heart failure, and people using different concomitant medications such as diuretics and MRAs in the background.
So thank you, Brendan, for the explanation of the use of the meta-analytic design and the entry criteria of type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease. Can you tell us what were the outcomes across the studies?
The primary outcome we evaluated was time to first serious hyperkalemia, defined as a serum potassium greater than or equal to 6, as well as a range of other potassium-related outcomes, including investigator-reported hyperkalemia, change in potassium over time, as well as hypokalemia, defined as a serum potassium less than 3.5. What we found was that overall SGLT2 inhibitors reduced the risk of serious hyperkalemia by about 16%, and that effect was consistent across the agents within the class and across different subpopulations and trials. This effect was supported by a 20% risk reduction in investigator-reported hyperkalemia events. And importantly, there was no difference in risk of hypokalemia, that is a serum potassium less than 3.5, between SGLT2-treated and placebo-treated participants.
Thank you for that summary. You know, one of the very impressive aspects of this clinical trial is certainly the size and the number of participants. So, Brendan, I was really struck by your description of the consistency of findings across the subgroups. And in particular, when I reviewed the findings in the paper, I noticed that serious hyperkalemia was higher in those with poor kidney function. Did you find that surprising?
From clinical practice, we know that one of the major determinants of hyperkalemia risk is kidney function. It's a major problem that we run into in people with more advanced CKD. And what that means is that for people with more advanced chronic kidney disease who are at higher risk of hyperkalemia, the absolute benefits of SGLT2 inhibition on hyperkalemia risk are likely greater in these individuals because they're at higher risk of this outcome. Other patients who might be at increased risk of hyperkalemia include those with heart failure or those taking mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists at baseline. And so you'd expect that if the relative effects are consistent across many subgroups, then the absolute risk reductions are likely to be large in people with taking MRAs or people with more advanced CKD.
Thank you so much for summarizing the importance of these findings and what they mean for our clinical audience. You know, it's wonderful to have this sort of information from a meta-analysis because it allows us large sample sizes where we can do things like you described, such as describing subgroup effects. It also presents us with very robust evidence that can be taken into clinical practice for our clinical audience to use. Based on what you found, how do you anticipate that these findings can be used by our clinicians?
Well, thanks, Mercedes. Well, I think the reduction in risk of hyperkalemia that is observed in these data suggests that SGLT2 inhibitors might enable better use of other proven therapies that reduce cardiorenal risk in people with chronic kidney disease and people with heart failure. We all know that in treating these high-risk patients, hyperkalemia is a problem, and by reducing the risk of hyperkalemia with SGLT2 inhibitors, it might enable better use of renin-angiotensin system blockade and mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists in people with chronic kidney disease and heart failure.
So you've provided a really excellent overall summary of the impact of these findings for clinical practice and the possible next steps. I wanted to end on a note of asking you, what surprised you about these findings that might lead to further future investigations?
Thanks, Mercedes. I think that's a really interesting question. What was somewhat surprising but also reassuring was the consistency of the treatment effect on hyperkalemia, regardless of how we defined it, whether that was defined based on investigator-reported hyperkalemia events or central laboratory-measured serum potassium levels, the treatment effect was very consistent. And I think that gives us some confidence about the robustness of these findings and their application to clinical practice.
Well, thank you so much, Brendan. I have really enjoyed this discussion with you today and this really important paper that is describing an important safety outcome for SGLT2 inhibitors in patients with type 2 diabetes. And again, I really want to thank you for sharing your excellent work with us here at Circulation. I anticipate that our readership, when they leave this podcast and pick up their journals, will be thrilled to read about all of the details about the excellent work that you and your team have carried out. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me, Mercedes. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you again to our audience for joining us for this episode of Circulation on the Run.
This program is copyright of the American Heart Association 2022. The opinions expressed by speakers in this podcast are their own and not necessarily those of the editors or of the American Heart Association. For more, please visit ahajournals.org.